Greetings from Long Time No See, the podcast. Every week, we'll be inviting two blindfolded comedians to answer a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Now, let's remove those blindfolds and start the show.
Hi!
What would your opening line with your celebrity crush be?
Loved you in Harry Potter.
Worst date you've been on?
A man bit my neck mole off once.
You did what?
A man bit my neck mole off.
Oh my God, Jack almost fell off his chair.
Be sure to follow and subscribe to the podcast.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Modern Drummer Podcast. Our special guest today is the one and only Earl Young. Hello, Earl.
What's happening, Billy? Burn, baby, burn. I'm here.
It is so good to see you, man. Look at those records. Look at that wall. Oh my God. God bless you.
My whole life is right here. My whole life, man, from birth up to here. This is the drum wallpaper.
That is like every musician's dream. I mean, to get one record is an honor, but my God, look at that wall.
Yeah, I got about 50 gold and platinum. You know, and over here is my Hall of Fame, my Hall of Fame, which I take pride of, you know.
Yep.
And
All well deserved. Is that the kit that you used on a lot of the recordings?
It is. Yes, it is.
This is
the second one. They built Sigma Sound built a set just for me, you know. And then I used this one and I used that one. But back in the studio, Joe Tarja would set up everything automatically for me. I mean, he was all the foot, because back then we had the Speed. Remember the Speed King foot pedals?
Yep.
I got both of the original Speed Kings, man. He had the all them babies up before you played. And Joe Tarja had everything for me. All I had to do was just walk in with my sticks, sit down, and play. I mean, he knew me so well.
Man, Joe was a genius. I mean, he was an innovator back in the day with all that studio. I mean, he invented a lot of outboard gear and equipment, right?
Well, you know what? We were like guinea pigs. I would not say guinea pigs because he learned from us. We worked in a studio like at least every other day we were recording something. So he was learning about us as we learned about him. So he learned how to adjust to my plan, you know, and he used to always get mad at me because I have a habit when I play with the back of the stick with the rim, you know, because I like a big fat sound. And he used to hate that because he used, you know, because it used to sound, you know, hard. But he adjusted to it. So what we did, we took and put a piece of cardboard around a snare drum. And so, you know, as high as the hi-hat, what we call it the sock cymbal back then, but it's the hi-hat, so it didn't bleed. I mean, we did all kind of stuff that nobody did in the studio before just to make that sound. I mean, I had a mic on the top, I had a mic on the bottom. Of every drum had a mic on top and the bottom. The cymbals too, and nobody recorded like that.
Right, right, yeah, no. And what? How old are you back at this period? How old are you at this time?
Right now, I am a young 81, man.
No, I know that. But I mean, back then, how old were you when you got into the studio with Joe and you started all this?
Oh, when I got into this. Well, you know what? I was in the studio before Sigma. I was in the studio back with Barbara Mason, back with 1965, before Gamble even got started. So I came in, I had to go back with Virtues because Virtues is where Gamble came in at. 1965, we did Barbara Mason and Johnny C. Blue Blue down Broadway, and Gamble was like, you know, watching things. So then Gamble came in, then Gamble started his thing with the Expressway to My Heart was his first record. I didn't play on that because Carl Chambers was a drummer then. So Carl, and that was like, I guess like 60, 68, somewhere in that 60.
Yeah. That was a big song. And that was a white group, right?
Yeah, that was his first production because Carl Chambers was a drummer then. And he played on the first hits, which was Cowboys, the Girls, United.
And that, what's it, his name is Paul Chamberlain?
Carl Chambers.
Paul Chambers, yeah, I think.
He was actually Gamble's, Gamble used to be a singer, and he had a group called the Romeos, and Tommy Bell, him, and Roland Chambers and Carl Chambers was his band. So he just took them into the studio with him. And that's how he got started with his own, you know, he just stopped singing and got them guys, man, went into the studio and recorded his first record.
Let's go right to the beginning. How old were you when you first discovered music?
Okay, let me get up to that. Let me give you a first little history of me, or how I got into playing drums, why I did it. Okay, well, first of all, I have to go back, because people think that it came up easy for me, but I want people to know the fact that I was born in prison. I was born in prison. I was raised in two foster homes. Back in 1940, we was known as colored. You know, we was colored then, so it was pretty rough and hard, you know, especially for me, you know, being raised in a foster home. And I didn't have a mother and father, so things was pretty rough. So what I did, I joined a parade band. And I learned how to blow a bugle. I could blow the taps, man, like nothing. But I wanted to play drums, but they didn't want me to play drums. But my stepfather, well, not my stepfather, but my foster father had a parade called the Knights of Pythias, which is named after a Bible phrase. And I told him I wanted to play drums. He said, no, I want you to be the leader of the bugle corps. And I hated the bugle, man. You know, I did it because it was my stepfather, my foster father. And I learned how to play. I could still play a bugle. But then I automatically said, well, drums is what is my calling. So what I did, I didn't have any money. I was a kid, man. I was like 14 years old. So what I did, I went and got four phone books, four chairs. I taped the tape around the phone books, and I put them in chairs, and I got two Maxwell House coffee cans. And this is how I learned how to play drums, man. I sat down with these phone books. They don't have phone books anymore. That's outdated. But to me, that was my drums, man. And I played that. And I had another boy that was in the foster home with me, and he was a great drummer. He just recently passed. His name was Jack Bell, and he was their grandson, and he could play drums. He could play everything. So we used to go to a theater called the Uptown Theater, where all the acts in Philadelphia came. I don't care who you was, Stevie Wonder, you came to the Uptown Theater in Philly. So here I am, I went to the Uptown to see Pearl Bailey. And when I seen Pearl Bailey, she was married to Louis Belson, the drummer.
Yep.
And I seen this guy up there with two bass drums. I ain't never in my life seen anybody with, and that was attracting me from watching her to him. I said, I ain't never seen somebody with two bass drums. I said, how can you play two bass drums? And I wasn't good. I mean, I wasn't really good, but I didn't know anything. I mean, I just wanted to play. And I ran into Norman Harris and Ronnie Baker. And Ronnie Baker played bass on the street, and Norman was a guitar player. He learned from Roland Chambers, which was in the studio. So I hadn't even gotten to the studio yet. We were just playing Chilling Circuit, which was like nightclubs, little corner shops. So we played, he said, look, everybody played James Brown. Back then, everybody played. If you played James Brown, you was good.
Yeah.
So I always played James Brown, man, because James Brown was the thing. So we opened up with James Brown. I had my little three-piece set, and I got paid $12 a night and a bottle of beer, man. People didn't care. Look, I had people, they didn't care nothing about the band. They throw chicken bones on you, and they walk up to you and they ask you, can you play Old Mary this or Old that? I said, I don't know that song. They didn't care what you played. You just up there playing, man. So we played. And I said, okay, this was like in the early 60s.
So that was almost like, you three guys were like a band then, pretty much.
Oh, yeah, we were a band. The three of us, we always been together way before the studio. We were always been together. But I've always had two careers. I mean, I've always had two careers, which was a singing career, because I sang doo-wop along with
right. Now, do you think, I wanted to ask you before I forget, do you think that playing the bugle helped you become a singer?
No.
Okay.
It just helped me want to get away from it, you know? But
So being a singer was natural to you?
Well, I wouldn't say it was natural. It was something I always wanted to do, because when I went to the theater, I used to see these guys, man, and these guys had all, I said, singers got all the women. So I said, this is what I'm going to do, man. These guys got all these girls, man. And I always had a deep voice. Well, I can go down as low as I want to. So I said, I can sing bass. So I had Jimmy Ellis grew up with me, and we put a record out called By the Exceptions called Down by the Ocean. So maybe somebody want to pull it up online called Down by the Ocean. And that's me singing bass and Jimmy Ellis. We were teenagers.
And let's let people know that Jimmy is the lead singer, became the lead singer of the Tramps.
Yeah, he's the lead singer of the Tramps now. So me and Jimmy had this little doo-wop record out. We didn't make the money. We got cheated because we didn't know nothing about publishing and writers' rights. The guy gave us the t-shirt and the hamburger, put us up on stage, man, and we sang doo-wop, and we went around the limousine singing doo-wop. So my career was going singing and drumming at the same time. So I loved doing both of them. You know, one because of the group where I had all these girls, man, and the other one because something that I always wanted to try to do. And I never had no really idols. You know, I used to look at Art Blakely, I used to look at Gene Cooper, Max Roach, Lloyd Belson, Philly Joe Jones. These were my heroes back then. Not that I wanted to play like them, because I figured I could never be able to play like them, because these guys would study and study and study. And I never was able to go to no school, or I never had a teacher to teach me.
I was gonna ask you, so you're self-taught.
Oh yeah, yeah. So what I did, I said, well, look, I'm just gonna play. You know, I didn't wanna play like nobody, I just played. So I had the ability to be a great timekeeper. I couldn't read no music, but I could keep time. So people give me a gig just because my timing was so great. I mean, I was like a metronome, and I could, look, you put it on, I'm right there. So this was.
And you didn't practice to a metronome, right? It was just natural.
It was just natural. So what happened when I got into the band, Norman Harris was always been like our leader. Norman was a guy, we all had, three of us, me, Norman, and Ronnie had three different personalities. Norman was a businessman with the suit. I was a street Cadillac guy. I was the player. Ronnie Baker was a mountain guy. When he finished, he'd go up in the mountain. He liked to be quiet in the mountain. He liked to adventure. So one day, when we got our break, was when Sam Reed, who is still alive today, a saxophone player, who was the band leader at the Uptown Theater, which is like the Apollo, and he said, look, I got a job at the Uptown Theater as a house band.
And this is in Philadelphia.
Right. This is the same theater that, as a kid, I sat and watched Louis Belson play. He said, look, I'm going to take you all in with me. I said, what? He said, yeah, I'm going to take you in as the house drummer. You don't have to play because everybody got their own drummers back then, their own band. But if I need you, you have to set in if somebody is missing. So I said, okay, let's do it. So I took my little raggedy set of drums and put them up there, my same little Lugwin pieced together, different color drums. And, I couldn't read a note, didn't know nothing about music, ain't never seen a music sheet in my life. So here it is, I'm sitting at the Uptown and Jackie Wilson was on the show with Stevie Jackie Wilson. And they had the Uptown at the corner, everybody knows the bar at the corner and back of the Uptown and the people that cook food across the street. You met the Uptown, everybody knows them. So we are during halftime, everybody goes to the bar and party up there on the corner. So Jackie Wilson, drummer, I guess he got a little intoxicated and he didn't show up. So Jackie Wilson said, Earl, you got to play for me. Said, oh my God. Here it is. Look, I'm coming off the street, man. But see, what saved me was I was a street guy. We used to have house parties with red and blue lights in the basement. And I played all these songs. You know, I was a Motown fan, and I played Smokey Robinson, you know, and Shop Around. And I knew all of the Motowns. I knew all the songs because I danced to them, you know. So I knew Jackie Wilson's song, Lonely Teardrops. You know, I knew all this. So he said, look, I told him, that I really didn't be in music, but I think I could play and stuff. He said, look, don't worry about it. Follow me. And we played. I was shaking like a leaf. I had the raggedy pair of drums. And he went on stage, man. And I hit that Lonely Teardrops, you know. And I kicked the hell out of it, man. I did the best I could. And he came back to me and said, he said, thanks a lot, Earl. I appreciate that. He gave me a little bonus, man. And
nice.
that was the start. The Uptown was the start of my career because I watched the drummers come in because they had better drummers. I won't say better, but they had great drummers in Philly. Yeah, I was working in the Uptown, a boy named Tiki, who plays with the Power and Funkadelics. He was there, you know, and they had a lot of good drummers from Philly that played for other artists. They used to play for other artists.
But now, that gig with Jackie Wilson, was Harrison Baker also on that, or they just...
Oh, yeah, we was a band, yeah.
Oh, they were, so that was the house, so you guys were the house band.
Yeah, we were the house band, but he used his musicians because
with you guys.
We still play.
Wow. So you see that I love stories like this because circumstance. If you weren't there that night, who knows?
To me, I was just lucky enough to feel great enough to be able to play with such a legend like him, man. You know, just to be able to dance on his records and then have to be up there like Louis Belson and play on the same spot behind another great artist.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's being blessed. I mean, that being in the right place at the right time. And then, so now I see the whole picture as you guys really formed a band and you guys were so tight. So by the time you did get to the studio and you guys were making records, you guys really had your shit together.
Oh yeah, we knew it. Look, we knew each other. Whatever somebody make a move, we knew what we knew how to make a move. So then, from the Uptown is when we got into the big league because the Uptown Theater was owned by DJ, well, it was run by DJs. Jimmy Bishop owned Barbara Mason. He had Johnny C, Boogaloo Down Broadway. They had Nella Dodge, Brendan the Tabulations, the Ambassadors. So they said, look, I'm gonna take the three, they're gonna take the three of y'all into the studio with me, and I'm gonna cut some records. I said, in the studio? Wow. You know, I mean, this is exciting to me. I mean, I'm a guy off the street, you know, with not much education. I didn't have a lot of, no money and no knowledge of reading music. So I get into the studio. So Norman did this, said, look, Earl, I'm gonna tell you what I'm gonna do. Whenever I nod my head, I want you to make a fill in that spot. Cause I didn't read no music. So Biggie would always sit on my left and Norman would sit up in front of me. Always, I don't care what studio we go to, this is how we sat always. Then we would never change our position.
Now, was those two guys in the studio already? Did they have studio experience?
Norman had played, just around, nothing really big for Cameo and Parkway, nothing really big.
Right, but they had a little bit of experience. Were they older than you?
I'm the oldest.
Wow, okay. All right, so now the three of you go into the studio.
Yeah, we go into the studio. So Norman sat here. So we're recording Barbara Mason. So I'm playing. I could always feel the groove. I mean, because I put my own groove to the record, but I didn't know when to fill. So when I'm playing, Norman would do like this. So I would make a fill in that spot. So Baker would look down at my foot, and he would play off of my foot. So that would bring us a double tightness where we were locked in together. Once me and Baker locked in and Norman, that's the whole section right there.
What a rhythm section. My God, unbelievable.
That's the whole section right there. Once the three of us lock in, everybody else, keyboards can overdub or come in. So that's how we did. And we cut, this was at Virtue Studios at Broad and Columbia Avenue. This was the first big major studio in Philadelphia.
So that was called Virtue?
Virtue Studios at Broad and Columbia Avenue. Everybody recorded there. It was they only had 8 tracks back then. There wasn't no 24 or...
Yeah.
They could record it, then double it again, then double it, you know. So we recorded Johnny C, Boogaloo Down Broadway, Brendan the Tabulation, Tip of My Tongue, and the Ambassadors. See, the disc jockeys ran everything back then. They ran the studio, they had their own label.
They had everything going, so it would go from the club to the studio to the radio.
All the singers came in, they told them, I'll play your record if you do a show for me. So it's all connected between the studio and the artist.
Right.
So I made $100 for the session. I said, geez, I can make $100 doing this? This is what I'm going to do. I probably deserve more. But that was great. I mean, look, $100 doing something that I love to do and get paid for it. Because at the time, I didn't really have an education to be able to, I couldn't hold a good job. You know, I didn't take orders very good. So I didn't have a good job. And for me to make that in like an hour or two,
Doing something that you love.
That was great. That was great money. So then Gamble seen us. Gamble started. Well, he was starting his company up at Cameo and Parkway. They had a studio over there too. So that's when him and Huff got together and they recorded their first record. Gamble took his band in there. See, we had our band, Gamble had his band. He had Rolling Chambers. I mean, that was a great band because he had Huff and he had Tommy Bell, which is a great producer. He had Rolling Chambers. Rolling Chambers, Carl Chambers. So they were a great band. So they went in the studio and they cut Ben Shooter's first stuff, Cowboy.
Was Anthony Jackson in that band?
I'm not really sure.
I think when I interviewed Anthony, because we spoke about you, because he did some stuff with you, of course, the OJs for the Love of Money and stuff. And he mentioned Paul Chambers, that he did a lot of sessions with him before you. He didn't get as much a chance to play with you as he would have liked, but he did do some records with you. So I got to look that up. I wonder if he was, I think that's when he was playing bass on some of that stuff.
Yeah, he might have. I don't know him. I don't know him that well because a lot of things was cut before me, like Billy Paul stuff, you know. He probably played on it because
I think he played on Me and Mrs. Jones.
Yeah, I didn't play on it.
Yeah, he told me he played with you on For the Love of Money. That was a biggie.
Yeah. So getting back to the first, how we got into it was
Gamble and Huff had their place.
Yeah, Carl and them, when he started up, Carl and them played on Cowboys, the Girls, United. And
that was the Intruders, right?
The Intruders. But then they for some reason they stopped, and we came in and finished the Intruders, and we came in and played I Always Love My Mama, and
wow.
and we win place the show. So everything we touched started.
What about Cowboys and Indians?
Cowboys and Girls is played by Carl.
Cowboys and Girls, okay.
Yeah. But everything we touch started going to go. Even like Barbara Mason stuff, and back then was hits. So they said, "Well, look, we're not going to break up this trio. When you call one, because they never had to call me. All you had to do was call either Norman or Ronnie, and we go."
Right.
They never called me on the phone and said, "Earl, come on, it's time to go to work." You know, Norman would call, "Hey, look, man, let's go," and we know we're going to work.
So you three guys were like the Wrecking Crew.
Absolutely, absolutely. I have big respect for the Wrecking Crew because they are, you know, we are just like them.
Yeah, because and that's what made it work, because it was a everybody was friends and they worked together well and they were experienced and they knew what to do together, and you pretty much like the Wrecking Crew, you guys created that sound. What became that sound?
Absolutely. So when we got so what we did when we started out, we got the hit on that hit on the Intruders. Then the next act we brought in Joe Simon, and we did Drown the Sea of Love, which was a big gold record. So these guys were getting happy, man, because everything we was touching. Then we brought in Archie Bell. And a lot of people don't know that I played Archie Bell Tighten Up, because they had Archie Bell and them had put it out first. So they say, "Earl, you didn't play on that because of Archie," because they did it first on a small label and it didn't sell. So when they got the album credits, they don't have my name on the album credits because they did it first, and they took that as if they hit the hit. But when they came,
so they redid that song?
They did it first. We redid it.
Oh, that's what I'm saying. So they did it, and then you guys redid it again, and that became the hit.
Right. They did it, and it didn't sell on another label. And they came to Philly, and we cut all the songs over again because I got the gold albums. So what happened was when they put the album out, they put it down the credit of the one that they did. So people think that they played on it. I guess they didn't want people to know that.
Well, they were a self-contained band back then, right?
They were a self-contained band.
Yeah. Well, that we all know that that's what happens back then. Most of the bands, only the singers were on the record, and most of the band guys were replaced.
That's you, man. Yeah, back then, self-contained, we didn't allow no bands to come in to record. No bands. The OJ's band, no bands could ever come in and record in the studio. If you got a group, you come as a singer, and your bands, not that they can't play, But the fact that it's easier to work with people that you've been used to working with all the time.
Right.
I never said we were the greatest musicians in the universe, but we are together just like the Motown guys. So when we did Joe Simon, then we did Archie Bell, and we moved. I mean, we kept just moving on. We just kept cutting and cutting. And the OJs came in. The OJs was our biggest group. We just cut hit after hit after hit after hit after hit after the OJs. But my greatest experience was when Wilson Pickett came in the studio, when they brought him in the studio, which Gamble didn't bring in Pickett. When Pickett came in, Pickett came in and said, "Put the music down. I want you to, Earl." He came over to me and said, "Look, this is what I want. I want you to put it right here." You know, he didn't care about no music, man. He said, "I'm gonna sing this song and I want you to put it right here." Because he dealt on feeling. He didn't care about no song. If you didn't feel it, you know, to him, you can't play. You can be the greatest drummer in the world, but if you can't lay that funk down there, you know?
Yeah, it can't be technical. Funk music and soul music can't be technical.
So, man, playing with Wilson Pickett Ball, that was a fun thing, man, because I love playing that kind of stuff, man. We laid that stuff down, boy. Don't Let the Green Grass Fool You. Man, came out there with two hits.
Wow.
That was an experience. And then we came in with B.B. King. B.B. King came into Philadelphia the same way. B.B. King sat right down in front of me, man, and I'm repeating myself. B.B. King, and he sat there with his guitar. He ain't caring about no music. I mean, these old timers, man, these guys, they deal on strictly feeling. They want to feel that music. And that's how I play. I play from feeling. I don't care about no notes. I want to feel. That's why I play hard. I'm not a great guy to do solos. I'm not a solo guy because, I never cared about doing solos. I always cared about, that ball on the floor, man, because that's how people walk. They walk to that rhythm, man. They don't walk like this. People walk like this. And if you can play like they walk, you can play like they dance. And that's the way B.B. King sat by and he said, "All I want for you is a groove." Okay. After I hit that groove, man, he said, "Damn." Man, we laid back, man, and then just, and the thing about it, with us, there is no drugs. I mean, with the studio, none of that drug stuff, none of that. What we do, one thing about us, man, in the studio, if we come to work, we come to work like a job. I mean, we just walk in there not knowing what we're going to record that day. We don't know what we're going to do. We could do church music. You know, we could do rock and roll. I play rock and roll. Whatever it is, I play it. We walk in there and we play it. And if one guy is not feeling good, they don't call in somebody else. I don't care what it costs. They count to the whole session. We didn't say, okay, well, Earl's sick today. Let's call in another drummer. That had never happened with us.
Because you got, once it was proven, And you have to hit records. It's this typical saying: if it ain't broke, don't fix it, man. That was the magic. It's like same thing with Motown, same thing with the Wrecking Crew. Phil Spector did that same thing. He used the same people because even though some people said, "Oh, it was superstition," but it worked. It's like that's what the magic happened, and then it just evolved, and the ball kept rolling, bigger, 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 and no stopping it. you know, you guys were so tight from playing and having that experience. And then in the studio, like you said, of course, they're going to, if they wanted you three guys, because that was the magic. And that's, you know, the songs, of course, became classic songs. So that was one thing. The songs were going to be there. Somebody had to record those songs. So obviously they got the right guys to make those songs even greater.
Look, when we come to the studio, we go in there knowing it's going to be a hit. I mean, you might think but we knew because we knew how to make a hit. If you got a good song, you got a good rhythm section, you got a good singer, you got to have a hit. If you got good writers, I mean, Motown is the same way. You don't go in there saying or even thinking that your song is bad. I mean, very few songs went on the shelf that we played on, you know? And the thing about it is that everybody, all the musicians got good ears. Because we have cut a song for 4 hours, one song. And we all go in the engineer in the booth and listen, not just the producers. We all go in and listen to it. And if one of us finds something that we don't like, we do it again. And if it don't come out right, we'll shut the studio down. Or we had a bar that we go to on 11th Street. We would stop and go down to the bar and play shuffleboard and just hang out to relax.
Right, clear your head.
So we all go down to the bar, get a little drink and relax, talk and joke, you know, and play around, maybe for an hour. And then we come back to work and we try it again. And this is how we do. A lot of money was spent making these records. They weren't just going to the studio cutting three songs in 1 hour. Sometimes we play a whole day on one song. If it ain't, it had to be satisfying to everybody, not just the producer, because they ask you, did you do your best on this? Or do you think you could do better? Nobody lies and say, oh, I like that, it's good enough, just to get out of the studio, because your reputation is at stake. We always figure, because we listen to Memphis, we listen to Motown, I listen to Al Jackson and them, because I had so much respect for Al Green and them, the stuff that they recorded, the laid back grooves. I had so much respect for the Motown sound. I listen to everything that they do. I listen to the fills that the drummers made, how they did it. So when they put a record out, I say, okay, my next OJ record, I'm gonna top that. They put a record out, I said, okay, when I go back in there with the Blue Notes, I'll fix them. So it was more or less a competition, not a battle, but it was a thing among each other where you have fun, man. Say, oh man, he played some nice stuff on that last song, man. Oh, so getting back to the studio, so now I ran into a wall in the studio because I was cutting so many hits that I ran into Tommy Bell. I had been playing with Tommy Bell before because I had played La La Means La La and Did Not Blow Your Mind. So I had already had some gold records for him anyway.
That was all the Delphonics, right?
Delphonics. But now Tommy Bell wanted to stretch out. He wanted to do some Bacharach kind of music. So now I had to learn how to read, because People Make the World Go Round has three different signatures, time signatures. You go from 4-4-2-4-3-4, ding 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 ding.
Now, what song is that?
People Make the World Go Round. That's a very hard song to play because you got to read. I mean, most of the drummers on the gigs can play it because they heard us play it behind the singer. But when you go into the studio with no singer and you're just picking up a piece of music, and you're seeing. On the hi-hat, you had to read every note. If you miss one note, the whole song is dead. So I couldn't read. So Norman and my partners took me into a room all day, and they taught me how to read. They said, look, this is what you got to do. You don't have to read notes, but you got to learn how to read the signs. So they taught me how to read the intro, how to read the repeat, how to do the first ending, second ending, the coda. And but I never read notes. I ain't never read a note in my life.
No, yeah, that basically it was like just a guide to show you like where there was a stop or a fill.
Yeah. If you learn how to read the signs, you don't have to learn how to read no notes because nobody's gonna write no rules down, no doom 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 doom. Nobody's gonna write that.
Right.
I mean, they don't write them like that. They give you the signs where you play 4 bars here, 8 bars here, 16 bars here, repeat, go back to the first ending, repeat back.
Right. And that song had different time signatures, as you said, so it was a little more complicated.
Yeah, I had to jump all over the page. I had to jump from the first ending, beat to the second ending, back to the first, then go back here, then go back there. So you had to learn where there was parts where you're playing drums and where you're playing the hi-hat. So right. I didn't do that. So, but I have never went into the studio and somebody tell me what to play. Daniel never told me what grooves to play. He just gave what I did. What I used to do is this. When we go into the studio, they give me a chart, a basic guitar chart, which just shows you the signs of where to go, back and forth, how many bars. And I tell them to bring the artists in. So they would bring in the artists, the OJs. Let's say the OJ. Okay. I got my chart. So I tell them, I say, look, Huff would run it down with the singer. As he runs it down, I would follow the chart. And he's singing it and he's playing it. So I know where the singer's going to break, where the song is going to go. I would mark in my own thing of where I want to put a fill in, where I want to change the groove at, and where I let them play the whole thing again. I read and I follow my own chart. And I said, well, I can put a groove here, I can put a groove here. After I finish my chart don't look like their chart.
Right.
Their chart is all notes that they have to follow. Mine's is basically what the singer is going at, where he's going. And so when they count it off, I know exactly how this song is going to go. I know exactly where to put the feel, like zoom, doom, 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 for the love of money. So I can come up with a groove. They tell me, well, my job is to come up with a groove. They don't say, Earl, play this groove.
Right.
Earl, they run it down. While they run it down, I'm putting the groove in my head because I got like 1,000 different grooves I can play. I can't play fancy drums, but I can come up with 1,000 different grooves because I like playing behind singers. I don't like just sitting down playing drum solos for myself or for people. I don't care how fancy you are on drums, how fast you are. You cannot come into a studio and take a chart and play. You cannot do it. I cannot go into a road with the Rolling Stones, anybody else, and just sit down and play. That's why I say there's no such thing as somebody saying you're the greatest drummer in the world. It's not, because everybody has their lane. My lane is a groove lane. I play behind singers. The Rolling Stones and them is a groove. They got records that they play over and over again for 1,000 years. They know them. I don't care how old they get, they're still playing the same songs. So that's their lane. So you can't compare one drummer with another drummer because you don't fit in that lane. I know I can't go somewhere and do a drum solo and I'll do somebody else. That's not my lane. But they can't come into my lane and sit down and play an OJ song like I do it. So all drummers are different. Even a drummer that's beginning to learn how to play, the guy just learned how to play is worth watching because he can show you something that you don't know. Because everybody is, I watch a guy just beginning and he might do something. I said, oh, that's pretty nice. I had never seen anybody do that before. So you always learn, I'm always learning and picking up. I used to listen to especially Al Jackson and them and I used to love the way they play behind the singers, man, because they got a sound that nobody got. They know where to put them fills to make that to make Al Green sound great. I mean these and the Motown guys. To me, the Motown fills, sometimes they overdub their fills, I know, because you can't play a fill and keep groove like that. But they know where to put that fill at. So that's their thing. That's their sound.
Right. It's creating things. All right. So talk about creating, right, and coming up with things on the spur of the moment and everything. You touched a little bit about how the way people walk, because I heard that even Sheila E. Jim Keltner says that they can tell how a drummer plays by the way they walk sometimes. So you, what made you with that Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, which has been on record, The Love You Lost, that was considered the first disco four on the floor open hi-hat song. What made that song, like that day, was that just was like came out of you? Like you didn't think about it. It's like that was the groove you felt that day. How did that all come about?
Well, I had been recording with the Tramps anyway, you know, back then, and Zing with the Strings in My Heart, you know, it wasn't like a disco song, but it was a groove. And the Blue Notes was really like a ballad groove. And Love I Lost was a slow song at first. It wasn't it was like, love, I love.
Wow.
We love, the love, I love. And we just go in there and say, look, man, I'm a fast song lover. I just like fast songs. I mean, I play ballads.
Well, and also because you like to dance.
I like to dance, man. I came up in the dance world, man, in the basement, man, with Red and Blue Light. We danced, all we did was dance all night, cha-cha, and the bummer, you know, and the bus stop, man.
Right, right.
Look, I said, put the groove. And I had a groove that I used to like to use, you know, like the skip, I call it the skip groove, like that.
Right, right.
Always put that in my records. You know, always like a signature thing. So I said, let's put it here. They weren't a disco group. I mean, we made them a disco group. They really are R&B, and with Bad Luck and The Love I Lost, Where Are All My Friends, you know.
Oh, and well, one of your greatest, one of the ones that you play that, I mean, is so... The groove, If You Don't Know Me By Now. I mean, talk about a ballad. That is so far behind the beat. And the feel of that song is incredible. So and Teddy's voice, of course, Teddy Pendergrass, you know, all the women loved him. He sang those love songs. And then, so you basically made that song a disco song.
And you know what? See, a lot of people don't know the drummer is what carries the song. You could take the same beat, like, if you don't know me by now, right? And you could play like a 6/8 and put it up. If you don't know me by
that. Right, right, right.
Instead of saying like, so it's really up to the drummer to carry the feel of that song, because you could take the 6/8 beat you know, make it a 3-4 or either one. And it's the same groove behind the song. And these are the things that I never went to school for, but I learned how to feel a 6-8 and a 3-4 is a basically, you know, after you have played these little chitlin circuit gigs enough, you learn all the groove.
Right.
I tell you the one song that got me to playing drums, the first song I ever played in a band that put me on drums was a James Brown. And when I heard There Was a Time, that's when I went into learning how to play drums. I don't know who played it, I can't say. But that was James Brown when it was first, and they don't play that song no more. You don't hear that one.
Yeah, I'm sure I heard it, but I got to refresh myself now.
Yeah, there was a time when I used to groove, there was a time I used to dance. Go wow. ahead. There was a time. Right there. When I used to dance. It's up there, man. I mean, that song is up there. It ain't no slow song, boy. You got to be able to grip.
And back then, there were no click tracks.
Oh, no. They didn't have no click tracks. There's never been a song in the studio that we ever overdubbed.
I was going to say, and no punching in. Like, you guys.
No, we don't punch. We do it over. No click tracks. They didn't have a drum machine then. Wasn't no drum machine.
Right.
No drum machine, no click track, no overdubbing, no punching in. The drummer played for 15 minutes. If you had to play 50, like my album, the TSOP album, I played for like 15 minutes on songs. You know, I mean, this was one of my greatest albums, man. Love is a Message. Love is a Message turned to one of the number one disco songs in New York City as a national anthem.
And you played on the Soul Train theme song, right?
Matter of fact, I recut that again. I think I'm gonna release it.
You should.
I'm gonna send you a copy of it.
Absolutely. I want to ask you a question. How did MFSB come about, and then that evolved into South Soul Orchestra? Because a lot of people, like, you got the Sound of Philadelphia, you got the MFSB, and then South Soul. So there's three major movements in music of sound.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.